Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Dear viewers, we continue our critical evaluation of the collection of the Quran as has been supposedly done under the auspices of the Caliph Abu Bakr رضي الله عنه. We have already started our voyage in this regard, and we have discussed one major point regarding the critique on the collection of the Quran. And the critique here, I mean the critique on the matn. So we continue this critique on the matn, or the text of the narrative. And the next point in this regard is we need to understand that this whole narrative gives us the impression that Abu Bakr رضي الله عنه, in his capacity of a caliph of the Muslims, had actually undertaken or resolved to collect the Quran in Suhuf. So the whole narrative gives us this ring that this was some sort of official collection which Abu Bakr رضي الله عنه was responsible of. And Umar رضي الله عنه, of course, was the person who advised him. But ultimately, the whole narrative, the scenario which the whole narrative portrays, is that it was Abu Bakr in his official capacity as the caliph of the Muslims who had resolved to do this job. Now, please keep this background in mind. And if this is true, then there are some questions which have arisen and which our previous authorities have actually raised on this particular issue. And the first of these is that if this was an official collection, then there are certain things which go absolutely against it. First of all is the issue that it seems that this whole scenario, this whole transfer, the way it has been reported, that the Quran was collected by Zayd ibn Thabit at the behest of Abu Bakr رضي الله عنه, and then later on it was passed on to Umar رضي الله عنه, and at Umar's death he gave the suhuf to his daughter Hafsa رضي الله عنها. So authorities have raised this question that if this was an official collection, why did Umar رضي الله عنه transfer the suhuf to his daughter Hafsa رضي الله عنها? After all, she was his daughter and she had no official capacity. Why did not he transfer the suhuf to the next caliph, Usman رضي الله عنه? So authorities like Tamanna Imadi, Abdul Latif Rahmani, Ali Qurani Amili, Theodore Nordicke and Friedrich Schwally, Arthur Jeffrey, Regis Blachier, and among others, other people, William Montgomery Watt, these are some of the people who have raised this objection that had this been an official collection, then these collected suhuf must or should have been transferred by Umar to the next caliph. In this regard, Tamanna Imadi has also raised the point that why did Usman in his times return these suhuf to Hafsa after he had made the copies? We know that Usman in his own times had made copies of these suhuf. So Tamanna raises this question that once Usman had acquired them, he was the caliph. So had this been an official collection, he should have kept them with him. Why did he return them back to Hafsa? So this is what he has said. And similarly, Ali Qurani Amili, he is of the opinion that had this been the issue, that since Usman had not been elected as the caliph in the life of Umar, and the matter was entrusted to a committee of six people, and since the caliph had not been elected, so therefore this is the reason that Umar transferred his these suhuf to his daughter Hafsa. Now the answer that he gives to this is that if this had been the case, if this is the plea that people take, then these suhuf could have been transferred easily to this committee of six people who were ultimately responsible of electing Usman as the caliph. So this again did not happen. And he further raises this point that the reluctance shown, because we have certain narratives that show that Hafsa رضي الله عنها, when Usman asked in his own times to hand over the suhuf to him so that she could copy him, so copy these masahif, there are some narratives which show that Hafsa رضي الله عنها was actually reluctant in handing over these suhuf to him. So again, Ali Qurani says that this is something which is very something which cannot be understood, cannot be explained. Why was Hafsa so reluctant in handing over these suhuf to Usman? After all, if they were state-owned in the first place, they should not have been with her. And in the second place, why did she not want to, or if she was hesitant in giving these suhuf to Usman? So this is a very weighty point which has been raised, that if this was the case, that if this was an official collection, then why cannot we see that this collection remain in state-owned personnel? It should have resided with people who were caliphs. For example, after Umar, this should have gone to Usman instead of going to Hafsa. So this is a very weighty point which these authorities have raised. Another point which has been raised by these authorities is that why was not this collected, so, why was not this collected suhuf implemented and enforced in the Muslim Empire? And Rahmani goes to great lengths in explaining how Umar Ritala Anhu in his own times had sent various people, various teachers of the Quran into various areas, and he had even fixed stipends for them so that they could freely do this job. So this is very strange that Umar making so much effort in spreading Islam and the Quran, and we find that these collected suhuf were never enforced. No one copied from them. Rahmani makes this point as well, that why did not anyone come forward and even make copies from this collected Quran or this collected suhuf? So on the one hand, we find that the state is not entrusted in enforcing or dispersing or disseminating these collected suhuf. And on the other hand, we also find that there is no person entrusted from amongst the Muslims to come forward to take a glimpse of those collected suhuf or to make his own copies, as was very customary in those times. People would make copies, their own handwritten copies. They would come forward and make these copies. So he says it's very, very strange that no one from amongst the Muslim population expressed his desire to come forward and have them copied. So this is another point. This is exactly the same point which has also been raised by Friedrich Schorle. He also says that after so many conquests of territories which ultimately came under the Muslim empire, so efforts should have been made to implement these collected suhuf, or to send these collected suhuf to these areas so that the Quran could be disseminated. And we find in stark contrast that there were areas in which Ubay ibn Ka'b and Abdullah ibn Mas'ud radiyallahu anhum, their collections being pervasively found in some of the areas. So he says that in stark contrast, we find some of these collections in their area. So why didn't Abu Bakr and his successor Umar, why did not both of them take pains in actually using this collected Quran for the purpose it had been collected? After all, its collection had a purpose behind it, and not only what that purpose was preservation, but also, of course, it was meant that whatever the collected Quran is, it should be freely found in the Muslim Empire. So this is another very weighty point which is subsumed in this main category, which is that if this was an official collection, then why was not this enforced in the Muslim Empire? There's a third point as well, which has been raised by Abdul Latif Rahmani, and he says that in the state-owned ownership of things, state-owned things which were in the possession of Abu Bakr, radiyallahu anhu, when he transferred them to Umar, and these transferred things have been reported by Suyuti in his Tarikh al-Khulafa, and the list of things that he says that that Abu Bakr transferred to Umar were, there was this Abyssinian slave, there was a camel which would fetch water for him, and there was this old cloak. So these were the three things which Abu Bakr radiyallahu anhu actually transferred to his successor Umar radiyallahu anhu, as reported by Suyuti. And here we find no mention of any collected suhuf. Obviously, if the suhuf have been collected, then these state-owned items which were transferred by Abu Bakr to his successor Umar, then they should have been mentioned. They should have been mentioned in these state-owned items. However, we do not find any mention. Here I would like to submit that this point raised by Rahmani does not hold water and does not seem to be as weighty. This is because the list that actually has been handed down to us, this list shows items of personal use. So this Abyssinian slave, the camel who fetched water for Abu Bakr, radiyallahu anhu, or the cloak that he would wear, all these are personal items. They are not official items. So had this been a list which would have delineated the official items, we could have perhaps raised it as a counter question or a counter pretext. But since this list itself gives us the list of personally owned items, so therefore this cannot be presented to make the case. So summing up, we can say that this whole point is very important. It says that the whole Quran, the suhuf which had been collected, they were supposed to be the official, they should have been in the official ownership of the state, because obviously, as I have said earlier, the Quran, the suhuf which had been collected, were collected by Abu Bakr in his capacity of the caliph of the Muslims. So these points show, except the last one, that they were not actually official in this capacity, because neither were they used by the Caliph Abu Bakr or Umar in spreading Islam, and nor we find them to be in vogue in the empire. And similarly, we also find that there are a number of other objections which have been raised, And why is it that this Quran was not kept in this official capacity? Why is it that it was not enforced? And why did not people come forward and make their own copies on this official Quran? So all these questions cast serious doubt on the fact, and we can say that this point raised by these authorities is very, very weighty, and it's something that we must consider seriously. Now, coming on and going on to the next point in this regard, the third point in this regard, before I introduce that third point, let me also first give you this background or this information which might already be in your notice, and that is that in the times of the Caliph Usman, we know that serious differences, as is reported in a narrative by Bukhari and reported by Anas ibn Malik, Raziyallahu anhu, he says that Huzaifa ibn al-Yaman, who was fighting with the Syrian and the Iraqi armies at the battlefront of Armenia in Azerbaijan, he came over to Caliph Usman and said that people have started to differ in reading the Quran and he must get hold of the Ummah, otherwise serious differences will arise in the Ummah. And it is said that Usman then ordered a committee of four people to, first he had Hafsa, he requested Hafsa Radhiyallahu anha to hand over those suhuf to him, and then he asked this committee to make true copies of this. And then he returned these suhuf after the copies were made. He returned them back to Hafsa. And then it is also said that all other masahif and all other copies of the Quran were destroyed and they were burnt, so that only these official copies should be followed. Then there's another narrative which is actually reported by Zayd ibn Sabit. And again, he reports something which is in the times of the Caliph Usman. He says that in this particular time, when they were making these copies, they were not able to locate a verse of Surah Ahzab, to be precise, verse 23. Minal mu'minuna rijalun sadaqu, it begins with these words. He says that this was the verse which they used to hear the Prophet, but they did not find it. And they did not find it with anyone except with one person, and his name was Khuzaymah ibn Sabit al-Ansari. And since the Prophet had regarded his witness to carry twice the weight, so therefore Zayd ibn Sabit accepted this from him. So with this information in background, I am now going to introduce the next point of criticism, and that is that we find that in the collection that took place in the time of Abu Bakr, as I've already pointed out when I read the narrative out to you, that it is said that there was a single verse of Surah Tawbah, or the last two verses of Surah Tawbah, which were found with only one person. And as I've already pointed out this earlier, that this one person varies in various narratives. So thus, let me just read out a couple of parts of the narrative which will tell you that there are various variants of this narrative which say that these last verses of Surah Tawbah were found with a single person. However, there is a contradiction here, and there are various narratives which report different names. Thus, for example, this narrative in Sahih Bukhari, narrative number 4701, it says that the last verses of Surah Tawbah, the last part of Surah Tawbah, was found with Abu Khuzaymah al-Ansari, and the words are hatta wajadtu akhira surati tawbah ma Abi Khuzaymah al-Ansari lam ajidha ma ahadin ghayri. So Zayd ibn Sabit says that he found this last part of Surah Tawbah with only Abu Khuzaymah al-Ansari. Now, another narrative, which is also in Imam Bukhari's Sahih, this narrative is 4402 and the previous one was 4701. So this narrative says, حَتَّى وَجَدْتُ مِن سُورَةِ التَّوْبَةِ آيَتَيْن مَا خُزَيْمَةَ الْأَنْسَارِ لَمْ أَجِدْهُمَا مَا أَحَدٍ غَيْرِ. Which means that this last part of Surah Tawbah, these last two verses of Surah Tawbah, he only found with Khuzaymah al-Ansari. So the first said Abu Khuzaymah, who's a different person, and this second narrative says that he found them with Khuzaymah al-Ansari. And then there's a third variation as well. And in this third variation, we find that Zayd ibn Sabit says, and this, let me point out, this variation is found in 6788. The number of the narrative in the Sahih of Imam Bukhari is 6788. And in this particular narrative, the narrator himself is not even sure who that particular person was. So he names both person. And the words are, فَوَجَدْتُ فِي آخِرِ سُورَةِ التَّوْبَةِ لَقَدْ جَاءَكُمْ. Then he obviously reads out that last part. لَقَدْ جَاءَكُمْ رَسُولٌ مِّنْ أَنفُسِكُمْ إِلَىٰ آخِرِهَا مَا خُزَيْمَةَ أَوْ أَبِي خُزَيْمَةَ. So this narrative, which is 6768 in its numbering, this says that the narrator is not even sure whether it was Khuzaymah or Abu Khuzaymah. Then there is another category of narratives. This is the fourth category of narratives, and this is recorded in Mujmal Kabir of Imam Tabarani, and the number is 4904. Here, Imam Tabarani does not even name that person, who that person is, and he just says Rajulun min al-Ansar. So the words are Hatta wajadtuha ma'a rajulin min al-Ansar laqad ja'akum rasulun min anfusikum. So this is a fourth variation in which in which no name has been taken, and it's just said Rajulun min al-Ansar, a person from the Ansar tribe. And then there is a fifth variation as well, and this is recorded by Ibn Abi Dawud in his Kitab al-Masahif, and he says on page 38 that the person with whom these missing verses were found were actually Haris ibn Khuzaimah. So he was the person with whom these verses are found. So I do concede the fact that some of these are very rare and Shah's opinions, as people would say. But the two main, if we take into consideration the two main names, so one of them is Abu Khuzaimah al-Ansari and the other one is Khuzaimah ibn Sabit al-Ansari. The rest I can ignore for convenience of discussion. They can be discussed later on, perhaps in another more precise way. But to get the feel of things in a broader way, I can easily say that the broad category of narratives says either Khuzaimah or Abu Khuzaimah. So let's analyze what happens if either one of them is present, because there are serious repercussions which result. Now, the first repercussion is that let's suppose that it is Abu Khuzaimah with whom these last verses were found. Now, if this was the case, then the question arises that where was Khuzaimah ibn Sabit al-Ansari? Because it was he, as I pointed out earlier when I narrated the report in the collection regarding Usman's times, it was with him that a verse of Surah Ahzab was found. Verse 23 of Surah Ahzab was found. So at this time, where was he? Because it is known that Zayd claims that the only missing verse here was that of Surah Tawbah. So where was he? Why didn't he come forward that he had a verse with him? And the second question which arises with him is that if this was the case, that there was another verse which was found later on in the times of the Caliph Usman, was not found in this particular collection, then shall we not conclude that these collected suhuf were not even checked? They were not even checked that all the verses had been collected or not, because it was only in the times of the Caliph Usman that it came in the notice of Zayd ibn Sabit that a verse had been missing. So after so many years, so why were not these collected suhuf in the time of Abu Bakr checked? And the third point which arises here is, the third question which arises here is, that we know that in the times of the Caliph Usman, Zayd ibn Sabit radiallahu anhu accepted a verse from Khuzaimah, the verse of Surah Ahzab, because he carried twice the weight of witnesses. He carried the weight of two witnesses. This is what he did in the times of his collection under Usman. However, entirely contrary to this, in the times of the Caliph Abu Bakr, he never insisted on two witnesses, because when he said that he would accept his verse from Abu Khuzaimah, he obviously very well knew that Abu Khuzaimah does not possess this weightage of a twice witness, as was the case with Khuzaimah ibn Sabit al-Ansari. So these are the questions which arise if we consider the fact that it was Abu Khuzaimah with whom these verses were found, these verses of Surah Tawbah were found. Now, the second thing in this regard is that if we now consider that it was Khuzaimah ibn Sabit with whom these verses were found, let us, for the matter of simplicity, consider the fact that we accept those narratives which say, okay, the last verses of Surah Tawbah were found with Khuzaimah ibn Sabit al-Ansari. Now, here the question would arise that then why did he withhold the verse of Surah Ahzab? Because obviously it was that verse which he had presented only in the times of Usman. He had come forward and said, oh, I have one verse which is missing and it is with me. And since I have the witness of two witnesses, my evidence is equivalent to two witnesses, it shall be accepted. So if he was the person with whom the missing verses of Tawbah were found in the times of the collection of Abu Bakr, why did Khuzaimah ibn Sabit withhold that Surah Ahzab verse at this time? He should have obviously presented it at this time. So these are the questions which arise when we consider the fact that it was Abu Khuzaimah or Khuzaimah. In both cases, these serious questions face us in the eye. Now, going on to the fourth misconception, or the fourth objection actually, or the fourth reservation which arises in this particular issue. And that fourth objection is that we find, as obviously is the case, that this missing verse was found with only one person. So that missing verse being found with just one person has been raised as a point of objection by Abdul Latif Rahmani. He says that the whole of Surah Barat was revealed in one go, as is evident from a narrative in Bukhari. And he also says that it was read out in the ninth Hijrah Hajj, which was offered by the Muslims. But it was read out by Ali. So how is it? How should we accept this fact that it was only found with one person? Now, considering the fact that the answer which has been given by, for example, people like Qurtubi and Ibn Hajar and Ibn Hazm, the answer that they have given in this regard is that it was not that this verse was found with just one person in his memory. What actually was the case was that this single verse was found with one person in its written form, in its written format. So it is not that it is being claimed that this verse was only found with one person's memory. No. These people, Ibn Hazm, Ibn Hajar, and Qurtubi, they stake this claim, they make this claim. No, when the verse says, when the narrative says that this verse was found with just one person, then they actually mean that it's what was found in written form with one person. Now, and obviously this is also corroborated by the fact that when in one of the narratives, the words of Zayd ibn Thabit رضي الله عنه are, فَأَلْحَقْتُهَا فِي سُورَتِهَا, which means that he already knew. And the word, this expression means that I then added it to its place in that surah. So obviously he already knew its place. But the question which still arises and which still bothers the mind is that even if it is accepted, as pointed out by Ibn Hazm, by Ibn Hajar, and by Qurtubi, that it was found in written form with just one person. Why? Obviously the Quran was written by so many people. We know that it had been jotted down by the Sahaba. So even if it is considered, even if it is accepted, as has been defended by Ibn Hazm and Ibn Hajar and Qurtubi, that it was found in writing with one person, otherwise it was in the memories of many people, again, this is still not an enough explanation. Because to me, to be found in written form with just one person is also very, very questionable. Now, let us move on to the fifth point of criticism in this regard. And as I am going along, let me remind you viewers that we are discussing the matan criticism, or the criticism which takes place on the text of the narrative. This fifth point actually relates to the fact that the methodology in which this collection was made is very questionable. And why this is said, this is because a person like Abdul Latif Rahmani, he says that this was not the normal way of Abu Bakr in going along with things which were of such importance. He would consult his shura, he would consult people of importance. So why is it that people like Usman, Ali, Abdul Rahman ibn Auf, Talha, so people of their stature, رضي الله عنهم, were not consulted? Why were they not consulted? This is something which he has raised. And he said that this consultation only remained between Abu Bakr, Umar, and Zaid. So this is something very unlikely, because the normal way in which Abu Bakr would go about doing important matters would be that he would consult all the members of the Shura, or most members of the Shura. But this is very strange that very important people were missing in this regard. The second point he has raised in this regard is that the whole task was a monumental task. And the people, more people should have been employed. Especially, we know that there were people like Ubay, of the stature of Ubay ibn Ka'b present there. So why is it that just one person was entrusted with this responsibility when it was a huge task and there were many other important people who were close to the Prophet or closer to the Prophet than Zayd? And why were they not entrusted or at least added to this whole task? Now, these points raised by Rahmani, they are important, obviously. They need to be gauged and they must be viewed with considerable importance. However, I would like to add another point to this particular methodology as well, is that this methodology also seemed very, very insufficient to me, because obviously the collected Quran, as we know, would have been written without diacritics and without declensions. So in the absence of vowel sounds and in the absence of diacritical marks, it would have been virtually impossible for people to read them unless they were memorizers. So if the methodology to preserve the Quran was to just have it written down and then consigned to oblivion, then how could this have been the proper methodology in preserving the Quran? Because the preserved Quran could only have been read who already were memorizers of the Quran. In the absence of diacritic marks, in the absence of vowel sounds, What good would this collected Quran would be to people who would be reading the Quran for the first time, or perhaps who would not be reading the Quran for the first time? They would have knowledge of the Quran, but they were not memorizers. And the absence of a memorizer, we can easily have two or three opinions in reading a text which is not vowelled. So perhaps a better option in this regard would have been to produce more memorizers of the Quran. So that would have been perhaps more productive, because it is the memorizer himself who gives these vowel sounds and these diacritics from his memory. It is his authority when he reads a written text. So a written text which is devoid of vowel sounds and diacritics is useless to a person who does not know the Quran properly, because then he would be making errors, because a written text can accommodate two or three or four variations, and it could be equally good for all these variations. So this fifth point also is very important in this regard, that the methodology adopted in preserving the Quran was something which obviously was not fully capable of preserving the Quran as it should have been done. Now, let us come to the sixth point of criticism which has been raised by authorities, and this I shall, for the purpose of a heading, I can introduce you by saying that authorities have said that the collection of the Quran, since the narrative says, took place actually in the wake of casualties which had taken place in the Battle of Yamama. So authorities say, who criticize this narrative, the text of this narrative, that this is a very, very improbable cause of collection. And why? This is because they say that, for example, Tamanna Imadi says that he refers to the list of martyrs of among the Sahaba who were martyred in the Battle of Yamama. He says that there is not a single prominent memorizer of the Quran in this list. So how can it be believed that it was the loss of memorizers which had actually escalated this whole process? Similarly, Abdul Latif Rahmani says that there is only one prominent memorizer, and his name is Abu Huzaifa, Salim, who is the Mawla of Abu Huzaifa. And Friedrich Schrolli and Theodore Noldike, they add this one name, and his name is Abdullah ibn Hafs al-Ghanim. So they say that there were just two people. And similarly, there are other people who say that in the presence of this data, how can this be linked to a whole collection when actually the memorizers who had been killed were so scanty in number? Now, before I analyze this point, it needs to be understood that this historical data, as I shall present before you now, actually at times leaves us inconclusive. And so therefore, whatever Tamanna and Rahmani and obviously Friedrich Schrolli and Theodore Noldike have gathered or posited, as I would show later on, it's hard to totally corroborate what they have said. But before I make this final assumption or final conclusion, let me read out or let me just delineate what our earliest history books say regarding the casualties which took place in the Battle of Yamama. Now, if you look at the books of Islamic history, we find that there are different figures of casualties. Thus, we find Khalifa ibn Khayyat, one of the earliest historians. He, in his Tariq Khalifa, which is the famous history book that he had authored, he gives the names of 24 people from among the Muhajirun, out of which 9 took part in the Battle of Badr, and 34 from among the Ansar who died in this battle. So 24 from the Muhajirun and 34 from the Ansar, which makes a total of 58 people from both these tribes. Khalifa ibn Khayyat also quotes two historical narratives which give two different figures. According to Zayd ibn Aslam, the total number of people killed was 450, out of which 140 belonged to the Muhajirun and the Ansar. Now, according to another estimate, which is this time by Sayyid ibn al-Musayyib, he says that the casualties were 500, out of which the memorizers were only 30 or 50. So this is what Sayyid ibn al-Musayyib says. Now, al-Bilazuri, another very famous historian of the earliest times, he in his Futuh al-Buldan, a famous book that he had authored, he says that the death toll, which historians differ in this matter, obviously says that, and he says that their estimates range from 700 to 1700, and some say they were 1200. So the total number of people, again, as I say, when they speak of casualties, they're not always talking about the memorizers. So they are basically talking about the total number of killed. Some of them, out of this total number, present their own view regarding the number of memorizers, and others remain silent. Let me go on. Now, according to Tabari, another famous historian, So Tabri and Ibn al-Asir, both of them, they say that 360 people of the Muhajirun and the Ansar of Medina and 300 of the Muhajirun who did not belong to Medina were killed. Now, this brings the total tally to 650. Now, according to Ibn Asir, 40 of these were the companions of the Prophet. 40 of these were the companions of the Prophet. Okay. Now, let's move on and see what some of the other authorities have cited or quoted in this regard. So, Al-Qurtubi, he says that 700 memorizers were killed in the Battle of Imamah. So, that is the only estimate that could be alarming and that has been presented by just one person, Al-Qurtubi, and that he too belonged in the 7th century. Ibn Kasir, in his Fazail al-Quran, puts the number of memorizers killed to about 500. However, this is what he has written in his Fazail al-Quran. But in his Al-Bidayah wa Nihaya, he says that those killed were 450 and included memorizers of the Quran, companions of the Prophet, and others. He has named 58 of them because they were famous. So this is how we can find out various people offering various estimates. Leon Kayatani, he has actually drawn up a list of 151, or the figure that he gives is 151. So these are the different figures which we find, which have been narrated or reported by various authorities. Of these, Khalifa ibn Khayyat al-Bilazurin and Ibn Nasir and Ibn Kasir, they give the names of those killed, and others just quote the number of casualties. Now, in the presence of this data, which I have just presented before you, it is very difficult to conclude how many people who had been killed were regarded as memorizers of the Quran. This is because if we read the biographies or the biographical notes of these people who had been killed, we seldom find them to be memorizers. But then again, historians at times do not hand out all the memorizers of the Quran, or at times they don't even specify that a person is a memorizer because it has not come to his notice. And also at times, even a person who is a partial memorizer of the Quran, he is called a Qari or the Quran or the memorizer of the Quran. So given this variation and given this fact that history has not handed down all the names of all the memorizers, and it has also not specified exactly who a memorizer was amongst these casualties, I would say personally that this data is inconclusive. And as far as the first five objections of the matn are concerned, which we have just discussed, they all were weighty in their own regard. But this sixth objection, which says that this cause of collection was improbable, in other words, the Battle of Yamamah, after which it is said that the casualties were actually the ones which alarmed Caliph Umar, who had come over to Caliph Abu Bakr and then pressurized him or convinced him into collecting the Quran. So these people say that this was insufficient evidence because very few memorizers were killed. But as I said, my own submission to this is that I cannot totally corroborate their conclusion in this regard. Their conclusion is perhaps based on insufficient data because it is extremely difficult from our history sources to gauge and to find out exactly the number of memorizers in this battle. So, viewers, this brings us to the end of this session, and we have covered some points regarding the criticism on the matn of the collection of the Quran narrative, which has been recorded by Al-Bukhari. And inshallah, in the next session, we shall now continue this journey, and then we shall critically evaluate the chain of narration or the isnad of this narrative. Aqulu qawli hadha wa astaghfirullah li wa lakum wa lisair al-muslimina wal muslimat.